This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
I am back. We captured Maduro. We'll talk about that. The Mamdani era in New York begins. That might get ugly. Liz Collin joins us to talk about the exit of Tim Walz in Minnesota. All that and more coming up on I'm Right.
Venga por mí.
Last night, on the order of the President of the United States,
aquí no esperan Miraflores.
And in support of a request from the Department of Justice,
no se tarde en llegar.
The United States military conducted an apprehension mission in Caracas, Venezuela, to bring to justice two indicted persons, Nicolas and Cecilia Maduro.
Cobarde!
Nicolas Maduro had his chance until he didn't. He effed around and he found out.
This was one of the most stunning, effective, and powerful displays of American military might and competence in American history.
Like, I don't understand yet how they haven't figured this out. And now, if you don't know, now you know. Because this is the way it's going to play out. And I think people need to understand that this is not a president that just talks and does letters and press conferences. And, you know, if he says he's serious about something, he means it. But don't play games. Don't play games with this president's in office, because it's not going to turn out well.
That was awesome. And I'll tell you what, we're going to get to the cautionary part of this whole Venezuelan experiment we're going into right now. I will get to that here in a couple moments. But let's just acknowledge and accept something here as red-blooded Americans, if you are an American, or just lovers of freedom. That's an amazing military accomplishment to leave way, way, way far from your home, infiltrate a foreign country that knows you're there, and snatch not just some nobody off the street corner, snatch the guarded president and his wife, who are surrounded by private security, from their compound and leave without a single death of ours. And look, you and I, we get to see the highlights, don't we? We get to see, but football, it's football season. On Sunday, we tune in, if you watch NFL, which actually I don't anymore, but you tune in and you see the passes and the blocking and the tackling and the running. That's what you and I get to see. But the truth is that everything you see on the field on Sunday took so much preparation behind the scenes. Hours in the weight room and practice and film, but that stuff that you won't ever see and then I won't ever see. We got to celebrate and cheer. Maybe you're still celebrating and cheering the snatching up of that commie dirtball Maduro. But rest assured, this was extremely complicated. It took a very long time to prepare. He was raising Cain.
This operation, known as Operation Absolute Resolve, was discreet, precise, and conducted during the darkest hours of January 2nd, and was the culmination of months of planning and rehearsal. An extraction so precise, it involved more than 150 aircraft launching across the Western Hemisphere in close coordination, all coming together in time and place to layer effects for a single purpose, to get an interdiction force into downtown Caracas while maintaining the element of tactical surprise. Let me talk a little bit about the preparation. After months of work by our intelligence teammates to find Maduro and understand how he moved, where he lived, where he traveled, what he ate, what he wore, what were his pets, in early December, our force was set pending a series of aligned events. The force included F-22s, F-35s, F-18s, EA-18s, E-2s, B-1 bombers, and other support aircraft, as well as numerous remotely piloted drones. As the force began to approach Caracas, the joint air component began dismantling and disabling the air defense systems in Venezuela, employing weapons to ensure the safe passage of the helicopters into the target area. We arrived at Maduro's compound at 1:01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, or 2:01 a.m. Caracas local time, and the apprehension force descended into Maduro's compound and moved with speed, precision, and discipline towards their objective, and isolated the area to ensure the safety and security of the ground force while apprehending the indicted persons. On arrival into the target area, the helicopters came under fire, and they replied with that fire with overwhelming force in self-defense. One of our aircraft was hit but remained flyable, and as the president said earlier today, all of our aircraft came home. Maduro and his wife, both indicted, gave up and were taken into custody by the Department of Justice, assisted by our incredible U.S. military with professionalism and precision, with no loss of U.S. life.
That's awesome. That's awesome. If you are a red-blooded American, you have to admit that's awesome. Now, let's get beyond the geek-out action movie stuff. So impressive. All the credit in the world to all the people who were involved in pulling this off. Why? What's the why? I know we hear a lot about drugs. It's about fentanyl. It's about fentanyl. Definitely drugs and drugs and drug boats and stuff like that. Look, I'm sure that's part of it. But President Trump touched on something. He touched on a bit of the why. It's way beyond drugs. Here he was.
And the Monroe Doctrine is a big deal, but we've superseded it by a lot, by a real lot. They now call it the Donroe Document. I don't know. It's Monroe Doctrine. We sort of forgot about it. It was very important, but we forgot about it. We don't forget about it anymore. Under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again. Won't happen.
Monroe Doctrine, Western Hemisphere. What is all this stuff? Let's just do a little Monroe Doctrine 101. James Monroe used to be president in the 1800s. Don't worry about the details of it. But remember, the founders of this country were emphatic that we stay out of Europe's business. And they even said why. They're always in some war. They're always fighting with each other. We don't need to get involved. We'll trade with everybody. We don't want to get involved. That is what the founders wanted. They did not want to get involved. However, they understood that proximity matters. And Europe can do what it's doing. That's fine. But we're not going to allow hostile nations right by us. We're not going to allow hostile nations, they were worried about Europe at the time, but any hostile nations to set up shop right next to us to harass us. You want to do that in your part of the world? You have a good time. You don't get to do it next door to us. That is the most basic 101 version of what the Monroe Doctrine is. And that, if let's say you're running Cuba, let's say you're running Colombia, that whole Monroe Doctrine thing should probably worry you.
Cuba is ready to fall, you know?
Yes.
Cuba looks like it's ready to fall. I don't know if they're going to hold out.
By the way, you have to do something with Mexico. Mexico has to get their act together because they're pouring through Mexico, and we're going to have to do something. We'd love Mexico to do it. They're capable of doing it. But unfortunately, the cartels are very strong in Mexico.
Very simple.
Mr. President, Colombian President Gustavo Petro, a couple weeks ago, he said he's got to watch his ass. And today, he said he's not concerned about anything happening to him in the aftermath of this operation. So just what your message is
about
that?
Well, he has cocaine mills. He has factories where he makes cocaine. And yeah, I think I stick by my first statement. He's making cocaine. They're sending it into the United States. So he does have to watch his ass.
Now those leaders of those countries know what that means. The United States of America is realigning its foreign policy back to being closer to what it was at the founding of our country. That foreign policy is your business elsewhere, thousands and thousands of miles away, is your business. If you think you're going to bring your bad business and park it right next to us, there's going to be a problem. So we shall see what the next 3 years bring. Now, for the cautionary part of it, Donald Trump said, remember, Venezuela's leadership is gone. Their VP is in Russia. Their president is in federal custody in New York City. So who's running Venezuela? We are.
We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. So we don't want to be involved with having somebody else get in, and we have the same situation that we had for the last long period of years. So we are going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. And it has to be judicious, because that's what we're all about.
Right. That's fine. Sounds good. I'm not yelling or screaming, but now's the hard part. It's not that the military part was easy. Don't get me wrong, obviously. All the bravery, all the planning, all the everything. Now, though, taking a country that has completely lost its way and establishing some form of government there that the people will accept and B is friendly with us, this is going to be a difficult part, and this part might get ugly. There are going to be some bumps in the road, I guarantee you. Let's pray for a good outcome. My personal belief is that we should simply colonize Venezuela and make it an American colony. I know that that's not going to land well with the rest of the world or really anybody in the political establishment, but I'm a huge fan of colonization, and Venezuela should simply be ours. That won't happen. We'll see where we go from here. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Joshua Phillip is going to break all this down for us. Let me break something down for you. You know what I have in our house? I have a little cupboard. Well, we have several cupboards, just like you do. We have a cupboard, and I kid you not, I'll take a picture of it. The top shelf of this cupboard, it's about 4 feet, I would say. It's just masa chips lined up. It's just the different flavors. They even have one churro now. It's like dessert. Well, chips are bad for you, right? Not masa chips. That's the beauty of it. I can go to my cupboard of chips anytime I want, snatch up. Maybe I want some habanero chips. Maybe I want some churro chips. Maybe I want some lime chips. They have the corn chips you can eat without guilt. No seed oils, none of that filth. Basic, simple, natural ingredients. How about that? You want to try them? You try one bag, I'm telling you, you'll have your own cupboard. Massachips.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
And remember, Maduro was handpicked by Chavez, was to push out the United States to eliminate the Monroe Doctrine. And so I think it's very telling right now that what did Trump just come out and say? What did Pete Hegseth just say? They're going to start restoring the Monroe Doctrine. They're going to begin enforcing it. We're going to start creating friendly nations, and we're going to start overthrowing unfriendly nations. And I think Maduro, you know, in Venezuela, I think he's going to be the first to go as part of this.
Wow. That's quite a Babe Ruth shot call, isn't it? We figure we should probably bring the man on to gloat a little bit. Joining me now, Joshua Phillip, host of Crossroads with Joshua Phillip. Joshua, I mean, the football is yours. Just start spiking.
Well, you know, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, first off. But yeah, you know, if someone were to ask me what's really going on with Venezuela, why does this matter? It's not really about oil. It's not really about drugs. This is about who controls Latin America. And what's interesting now is this is kind of the narrative coming to the surface. You know, as we talked about in your show last time, Maduro might even just be one of a few who gets toppled like this. If leaders in Latin America don't play ball with the Trump administration and the restoration of the Monroe Doctrine. In fact, Marco Rubio just came out. Here's what Rubio said, quote, "This is our hemisphere, and President Trump will not allow our security to be threatened." And you also now have a U.S. spy plane circling the beaches of Mexico. So something big's going on, and I wonder who's next right now.
Okay, before we move on to who's next, and believe me, we will, Trump said, that we're going to be running Venezuela, you know, until we can make some sort of a transition. That, of course, is going to be the truly difficult part. What does that look like? What do we do from here?
Well, I think you're going to have a few different issues. So Trump is not ruling out the possibility of troops on the ground. And the Secretary of Defense, you know, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, they've now created U.S. Southern Command. That was part of the whole operation of reestablishing the Monroe Doctrine, reestablishing U.S. the United States asserting influence and basically regional control over all of Latin America. You might have U.S. troops deploy there, or, you know, peacekeeping forces deploy there. Because what's happening now, the remainder of the Venezuelan military, they're hunting down people they say, you know, effectively told or cooperated with the Americans to find and capture Maduro. They're also now trying to put down any kind of unrest. And on the Trump side, they're now working to have a transition of power. So the Trump administration is going to start facilitating the creation of the new government in Venezuela, whatever, you know, whatever that may be. You already have the government in exile. Already they were the ones who won the election back in 2018. And already things are in place, but you're going to have a brief time of military risk. And maybe not too strong, because the military there, they do not have popular support. And also the military there, they're basically like a glorified militia. They're not that powerful. So I think that's going to be the next step.
Who's running things there for the military? Is there some general in charge? Because it's my understanding the VP is in Russia, and the president, along with his wife, are in New York City. So who's the guy calling the shots?
Yeah, they got an unexpected vacation to New York. Right, the trip they had in mind. I don't know who is exactly in charge in Venezuela right now. It is alleged a lot of the people closest to Maduro might have been taken out in some of the early strikes. We don't really. I think it's kind of like if you have a line of ants and you drag your finger across it. That's what's happened to the Venezuelan leadership right now. The other important point, though, none of the generals, none of the top officials with the military in Venezuela are in secure positions. Because, and this ties to Trump's designation of the Cartel of the Suns as a terrorist organization. This ties into his declaration that they're not only that, but, you know, effectively the entire leadership of Venezuela was in cahoots with it. What you see now happening to Maduro could be used against any other military leader in Venezuela. And my assumption is this. When they want to go after them, when they do this peacekeeping operation, it's not going to look like Iraq. It's not going to look like we get involved in, like, you know, full-on military invasion. It's going to look like a special forces raid that grabs the guy out of his basement at night, you know, 2 a.m. and drags him to New York, or just bombs him. Because, again, they're now designated as terrorist leaders. The actual U.S. designation against Maduro, his wife, against these top generals, is they're terrorist leaders, which opens the door for all kinds of military action, you know, whether people agree with it or not. So I don't think they're acting from a position of power. I think they're acting from a position of fear right now.
All right, let's transition to Mexico. It's not hard to envision the kind of thing we could do to Colombia or Cuba. You know, they're ripe for the picking, just like Venezuela. Mexico's a bit of a different nut to crack. Half the states are narco states. It's just much more complicated. What do you envision there?
Well, Mexico's in a tough position. The reality of Mexico is, you know, what's their economy? It's a lot of remittances, people coming to the United States, working illegally and sending money home. A lot of it is in, narcotics. You could argue that they have a big legitimate economy. It's manufacturing car parts. It's, you know, a lot of that, right? A lot of manufacturing jobs went to Mexico because of, you know, the trade agreements we made with them in Canada. But a lot of the money for the regular Mexican citizens, the average poor person in Mexico, is either drugs or remittances. And the problem you have is in a lot of the countrysides, in a lot of the poorer areas, literally the entire area is controlled by the cartel. The cartel is the government, the cartel runs the hospitals, the cartel does the food drives, the cartel is basically the government. And there's something I refer to as the ecosystem of corruption. The ecosystem of corruption, in my opinion, is what drugs are really about. This is why China The Chinese Communist Party supplies the precursor chemicals for it. It's why the Chinese Communist Party supplies the synthetic drugs. It's why the Chinese Communist Party does all the money laundering through Chinese state banks. It's because this is about using the ecosystem of corruption to effectively create power structures and then control them. Because, let's put it this way, if the cartels are the government, which they are in many parts of Mexico, it means that they can kill their opposition because they use extra legal processes to kill their opponents. That means they have a de facto, unchallenged, undisputable power structure. Heavy systems of, you know, gun control in Latin America, the guys with the guns run the shop, and they're very powerful. If the cartels are the government, whoever controls the cartels controls the country. That's the real picture of it. And so for Mexico, basically, a lot of the elected leaders, if you're going to get into power, you have to play ball with the cartels. And if you question the cartels, they kill you. It's simple as that. Now, Trump wants to go after the cartels. Trump wants to destroy them. What does that mean for Mexico? It means that the entire social support system for their poorer citizens is now at risk. If they lose drugs, if they lose remittances, if they lose the manufacturing jobs, that's basically the entire Mexican economy. They're basically a kleptocracy, you would call it, like a country that revolves around theft and criminality in terms of how they make their money. Trump might find ways to rebuild that. That is part of the restoration of the Monroe Doctrine. They're actually promoting a kind of replacement of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative of infrastructure projects, manufacturing projects, resource projects all through Latin America. But that's going to be a ways out. Trump said in a previous statement, they know where every single cartel leader lives. They know where every single cartel facility is. What might that look like? It might not be that Trump goes in there and says, hey, you know, time for a new economy, Mexico. It could be that they say, look, you work with us or you don't. We're going to go in and we're going to carry out these operations and try to stop us, because he knows Mexico cannot survive without America. He knows the entire Mexican economy depends on the United States. Diplomatically or economically, they cannot afford to break ties with the U.S. And so Trump, in reality, has carte blanche to do whatever he wants. The only intervening force he needs to worry about to an extent would be the United Nations. They have very little influence over the United States in general, because America pays the bills and America can just pull that out if we really want to. So I think you're going to watch a lot of talking heads and a lot of noise, but I think Trump is going to go in there and just start killing cartel leaders.
Mm. Sleep well, fellas. Joshua, awesome as always. I appreciate it, man. All right. We have to go take a hard look at what's going on in Minnesota right now, because Tim Walz just announced he's not running again. Who better to do that with than Liz Collin? Before we join Liz Collin, let's talk about testosterone, your energy level. I tell you, this is no joke, and I know it's the most cliche thing in the world. Gathered my family up and I said, hey, 2026 is going to be the healthiest year I've had in years. Maybe you want to join me in that. I'm 44, going to be 45 this year. Part of that for me is making sure I take a male vitality stack from Chalk every single day. Keeps my energy through the roof, keeps my T levels through the roof. My brain works better. I am focusing on making sure my body is as good as I can make it in 2026. You want to join me in that? How about some natural herbal supplements from Chalk? It'll change your life. Chalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, falls from grace are something that fascinate everybody, fascinates you, fascinates me. Sometimes you cheer if you hate the person, sometimes you cry if you like the person, but political falls from grace are something to behold. Tim Walz, like 5 minutes ago, was the VP pick for Dome, for Kamala Harris. This man was, almost a heartbeat away from the big chair, and now he announces today that he's gone. How does that happen? How does a man go from that to gone. I don't know. Let's talk to Liz about it. Joining me now, great reporter, senior reporter at Alpha News, Liz Collin. Liz, how does one fall so far so fast? What happened?
Hi, Jesse. It seems that people are actually paying attention now. That seems to be the biggest part of this. I don't think the reporting has changed much, but the results, I think, sure have. Many political scandals on the watch of Governor Tim Walz, but it certainly seems this billion-dollar fraud scheme was just too big to keep Governor Tim Walz on the ticket. $9 billion in counting at this point. Multiple federal investigations ongoing, kind of just launched in the last few weeks here in Minnesota. You know, compared to mainstream media here, we have been one of the few, and certainly I would say the most prominent in the state, criticizing the governor, reporting factually on him. We have been for several years with our exclusive reporting. Perhaps not the end of him, though, Jesse. We are hearing behind the scenes that there may be a deal worked out where we have Senator Amy Klobuchar run for governor. Governor Walz gets her seat in the Senate. Since she was just reelected back in 2024, her term would not be up until 2031, meaning that Walz could serve a bit there, and then there would be a special election. So we have a bit of Joe Biden, you know, backdoor dealing, it seems, going on in Minnesota at the moment.
Liz, all these scandals, and you, like you said, you've been all over these things. How many of them are tied in any way to Tim Walz? Now, I realize he's a prominent politician, so there's always going to be layers here and layers there and layers there. But how much of this stuff was he actually, or people close to him, implicated in?
You know, in his last 7 years here, really was quite something to hear this. You know, they called it a press conference today. I wouldn't call it that. They took no questions, and he made this bizarre sort of these statements for about 7 minutes or so, appeared very angry. But it's hard to describe really what Minnesotans have lived through these last 7 years. We are the home of the Defund the Police movement. Tens of thousands of people have moved out of the state. Education rankings have tanked on his watch. Thousands of businesses have shuttered. Many of these mandates we see in place have been instilled by him. It has been 20 years since a Republican held state office in Minnesota, but just on the watch of Governor Walz. He was obviously in Congress before his time as governor in Minnesota. So much has changed. And I guess the question is, will he now avoid accountability for fraud? Many people are still wanting answers. House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer, we heard from him on X today. He says he's still demanding Walz appear on February 10th to testify in D.C. So we'll certainly see if he answers questions at that time. Just you know, to point out, Jesse, we tried to even attend this, you know, so-called press conference today, but we were not on the list, we were told. So our photojournalist was turned away. But we see that again and again at every turn with the Walz administration. They don't want to take questions.
Not on the list. All right, Liz, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I could imagine you being a little frustrated in that you've been covering all these scandals in Minnesota, you've been screaming it from the rooftops, the house has been on fire for years, and just now people like me wake up and we're smelling it for the first time. Why did this get national? What happened? Is it the Somali daycare stuff that really ticked people off?
Yeah, you have Nick Shirley. I think he came in and did some great work with our whistleblower, David, in tow from Minnesota, who'd done much of the research. We've been covering fraud for about 10 years over at Alpha News. I've been involved for several years doing a lot of these door knocks as well. I don't have a hoodie on, and I'm about 20 years older than Nick Shirley. But I commend him. Anything it takes, I think, to get attention. So many of us have been kind of screaming from the rooftops, as you say, and I know you've been nice enough to share our reporting over these years, Jesse, so we're thankful for that. But it does seem, in a way, that there was some sort of coordination just because of the federal agencies, multiple federal agencies sort of swooping in at the same time, whether it was, looking to have access to our voter rolls or what the heck is going on with our SNAP benefits, this welfare fraud that we've seen in Minnesota, and these 14 Medicaid programs that are now under the microscope paying out $9 billion in taxpayer money. So I think there was so many things that kind of came in all at once that it does seem that there was some movement. And I'm not sure if that it was that the Democrats who basically said we need to get walls out of here. He's very vulnerable. We were surprised, in fact, that he even announced he was running for re-election back in September, hearing about these, you know, sort of Klobuchar rumors even back then. We've heard that he struggled even fundraising in the state, which is why we saw him on the road out of state, out of Minnesota, trying to raise funds for these many months. And I don't think he's been very successful there either.
Liz, what's been crazy to watch, not surprising, but crazy to watch, is the lengths the national media and local media there has gone to try to cover up all this fraud stuff. Here's a montage.
How do you know that all the allegations that you're making are true?
How do I know that they're true? Well, we showed you guys what was happening, and then you guys can go ahead and make your own analysis.
We're coming so we can make our own analysis. Are you 100% sure you're true?
Yeah, I am 100% sure I'm true.
CNN is looking into Shirley's claims.
Hi, my name's Whitney Wild. I'm a correspondent for CNN.
We reached out to several of the daycares featured in the now viral video. Only one daycare facility answered and said they are a legitimate business.
In this case, you know, we know there are inaccuracies in this video, and it wasn't fact-checked like it would be at a major news organization, and yet J.D. Vance and others are holding this up and saying that the legacy media should take notes, which is, of course, pretty ridiculous.
Those daycares, many of them were written up for safety violations, things like maybe busted equipment or staff training issues, but that's not the same as being fraudulent. So it's important to put all of this into context. Granted, fraud is indisputably an issue in Minnesota, and there are 14 programs, Medicaid-funded programs, that are currently under investigation by state and federal government, but childcare is not one of them.
Liz, the question is why? Why would the media run cover for such a thing now that they've been exposed? What is the driving motivation here? I know you've been seeing this for years. You've been a journalist for a long time.
Yeah, I guess if I wasn't laughing at this question, I'd be crying at this point, Jesse. But we see this again and again on so many levels. So the Star Tribune, the guy running the place over there, Steve Groves, is a former commissioner of Governor Tim Walz. They're very good friends. That's well documented. I saw this myself as a longtime news anchor for the CBS affiliate WCCO in town. Not so much what the media is telling you, but what they are not. You really have a media in Minnesota controlled by the left, controlled by the DFL party. So many of them are just indoctrinated believing that they can trust so many of these leaders, and they're just fine to perpetuate these lies. It's almost like common sense doesn't even exist. We saw that with Nick Shirley's video. The story wasn't about the fraud. The story was about Nick Shirley. There were hit pieces about this whistleblower that came forward, and in fact, this is how they were spending their time. In fact, you had the media go out to some of the same sites that Nick Shirley documented in his video, and they would report, you know, there's nothing to see here. Everything is filled up. There are kids being bussed in. Nothing to see here. Well, don't you think that might have something to do with the fact that this was exposed on such a global scale in Minnesota? And we've seen the media quickly pivot, and they've already moved on.
Liz, hang in there. Keep bringing us the truth. I appreciate you very much. Well, anyway, let's discuss something maybe even worse than Minnesota, New York City, and where it's going. It doesn't look good. Before we discuss that, let's talk about something terrific. It's the year 2026, and life is expensive. I get that. What if right now, what if you made a little bit of a late New Year's resolution to save some money and patronize a business that loves your values and shares your values this year? You know, when you switch to Pure Top, the average family saves $1,000 or more a year, $1,000. Could you use an extra $1,000 this year? I'm not asking you to sacrifice anything. They're on the same network as the big guys. Switch. Their CEO is a Vietnam veteran. They hire Americans. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. One of the best decisions my family ever made. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
Today begins a new era. We will draw this city closer together. We will replace the frigidity of rugged individualism with the warmth of collectivism. I was elected as a democratic socialist, and I will govern as a democratic socialist. I will not abandon my principles for fear of being deemed radical.
That's not good. I just got back from New York City like a week ago. And I'll be honest with you, when we got back, we thought to ourselves, well, that might be it. That friggin' dirtball just got sworn in on the Koran. That's a great place to be. Joining me now, somebody who's probably about to suffer, is Lydia Moynihan, New York Post correspondent. Lydia, I hope you've already got some plans to move or something, because that city's about to go to crap.
I'm joining you live from the People's Republic of New York City. I'm here to stay. You know, I'm a little better armed. I have about 5 canisters of pepper spray, one in each coat. So it's baby steps. But for now, I think I have to be live on the ground doing some shoe leather reporting so you can see how horrible it is.
Lydia, when I say things like that, or when you say things like that, people are tempted to say, well, Bill de Blasio was a radical, right? He was a Sandinista. I mean, his parents were, but they say, well, New York's gone through this stuff before. I don't think people fully grasp that this guy is a true believer who's going to be so much worse than Bill de Blasio.
Yeah, and it's alarming. And there's actually a new poll that came out recently that said as many as 60% of New Yorkers now support socialism. So I also think we're looking at a demographic change that didn't exist under de Blasio. So we have way more people from third world countries, way more socialists here than ever before, who I think will be much more supportive of these policies. The other thing, too, is when de Blasio came in, there was so much impressive governance for so long. And I love this Adam Smith quote, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. So it felt like New York was in a really good place and there was a lot of ruin in this city, because you'd had Giuliani, you'd had Bloomberg, people who were super efficient technocrats who understood how to govern, how to keep people safe, how to keep business leaders happy. And so when de Blasio came in, things were already pretty good. And so he, you know, obviously took us down many notches, but we were already doing so well. Zoran Mamdani is coming in a moment where New York is already struggling. Obviously, the pandemic, people have fled. It feels very unsafe. A lot of people, you know, just anecdotally, young women I speak with don't want to take the subway. It's more expensive. He's coming in at a time where I think his leadership could be perilous. And I guess there's two things that I have, my takeaways in his very short reign thus far. The first is alarming. Personnel is policy. And so the big question, obviously, when he won was, who is he going to put in place? You know, who's going to run schools? Who's going to run the police force? We have Jessica Tisch, who actually is a really smart and capable police commissioner. But the other people that he's appointing, the tenant czar, essentially, to advocate for tenants' rights, she, socialist and communist, doesn't even describe her. She thinks owning property is basically white privilege, and she wants to abolish that. The gentleman who he's appointed as school commissioner is all about equity. He wants to get rid of all of the gifted and talented school programs. So I'm looking at people that he's putting in place, and they are just as, if not more radical than Mamdani is. And so the more people that he puts who are aligned with him, the worse it is for the city. One thing that I actually, this was a hilarious viral moment over the weekend, where Mamdani basically said that he'd called President Trump to register his opposition to bringing Maduro to New York. And it's just hilarious to think that anybody would care what he thinks, least of all President Trump. And of course, you had Jim Hines, who's the House ranking member on the Intelligence Committee, who's talking about how he hasn't talked to President Trump. He hasn't talked to anyone in the administration. But Mamdani is claiming that actually he has spoken to Trump and people in the administration. I'm skeptical. The reason I bring this up, though, is because what we've seen from Mamdani over the last year is an obsession with relevance and an obsession with being on the national stage. And so my theory, this is the best case scenario, is that Mamdani just likes making headlines, he likes being in the news, and that he just wants to basically stay as a national figure, make sure that he's sort of part of the zeitgeist, and that that's his motivation. So that's the best case scenario, is that he just really wants to be relevant and he's going to post all these crazy things on Twitter and not actually govern. And of course, the reality is he's never had a job. He didn't show up to the majority of votes when he was in the council in New York State. So he is very feckless, and there is still a hope that maybe he just isn't going to be that good at actually implementing the radical policies that he has. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is he has appointed some pretty terrifying people, and the city will go to hell in a handbasket.
What do you know? A communist leader who never had a job and is now going to destroy everything. And speaking of those feckless leaders, let's meet really quickly the new head of the New York Fire Department and also, I'm assuming, softball team.
Lillian Bonsignor is a career first responder. In just 9 days, she'll be running the world's busiest fire department, one of the most important appointments of the incoming administration. Although she never served as a firefighter, she's confident that won't matter.
I know the job. I know what the firefighters need, and I can translate that to this administration who's willing to listen. I know what EMS needs. I have been EMS for 30 plus years.
Bonsignor is a trailblazer for the LGBTQ community, who will serve as the FDNY's first openly gay commissioner. She's a highly respected, detail-oriented manager whose style has been compared to NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch, who will remain in her post in the new administration.
Lydia, I just hand it to you. It's your commissioner.
DEI is alive and well in New York. Look, we saw what happened in California when you prioritize identity politics over competence. And it was just a year ago that the Palisades were completely destroyed. People's lives have been completely decimated as a result of that. And I think my concern is that, again, it's not just that she is ill-equipped and unqualified. It's the ripple down effect. And so we in New York have, and as we know from 9/11, we have the bravest, the best, the smartest police officers and firemen. And the concern is when you have somebody who's running those organizations, I think Jessica Tisch is excellent at what she does, when you have an FDNY commissioner who's all about identity politics, that's going to have a massive triple down effect where people who otherwise would be motivated to work really hard are going to be like, this is the most poorly run organization. Why am I here? And so we're already seeing members of the police force, members of firemen leaving, and there's kind of, I think the force is going to get a bit hollowed out, because if you're a young person, you're going to just flee, go to Florida, go to Texas. There are actually a lot of other states that are actively recruiting NYPD, people who are firemen in New York, because they know they're really smart and talented people and are probably looking for an exit opportunity. So people who are younger and still able to sort of flee are going to leave. And then you're going to see people on the sort of upper end, people who've served for quite some time, maybe they'll finish out their tenure, get their pension, and then they're going to leave. They're going to do private security for billionaires. This is sort of the trajectory for a lot of really great NYPD people, is they get their pension and then they also work full-time for a billionaire as a driver and security, because obviously there's going to be a lot more billionaires wanting to hire their own private security, because it doesn't seem like Mamdani is going to be supportive of the NYPD. And then you're going to see in the middle, there's going to be a lot of people who are stuck and can't leave. But this is the big concern, is that it doesn't even matter that Zoran Mamdani has backtracked and said actually he doesn't want to defund the police. This is about, in practice, people are going, even if he doesn't defund them, even if he keeps funding exactly the same, people are not going to want to serve under a man and under a mayor who has just called them racist and horrible things, who is not going to be supportive of the work that they need to do. And I mean, you look at what Alvin Bragg did to Daniel Penny. That's going to be happening tenfold. And as a police officer, I can't imagine wanting to ever get involved. They're just going to be sitting on the sidelines. And, you know, even if they're still there, they're just going to be on their phone. They're not going to want to step in, because they're not going to have a mayor or a police commissioner, if Jessica Tisch leaves, who support them and who are their advocates.
Well, this is all pretty much terrible. Lydia, protect yourself, all right? Hopefully we talk to you again soon. Lighten the mood. Next.
Next.
You know what cracks me up? I think about this sometimes. A few years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, I don't know. I don't keep track of time at my age. Started to realize that we're dealing with communists. You know, they're not Democrats, they're not liberals, they're not even lefties or whatever progressives, or whatever word they want to put on themselves, they're just communists. Our Democrats in our country are communists. They know they're communists. For the most part, they know they're communists. Some don't, but that's what they are. There's not an inch of daylight between them and a Soviet apparatchik. There's just not. And you can see this all the time with the affinity they have for other communists around the world. You know, Chavez, Hugo Chavez, he was the guy who took Venezuela from being this super wealthy country in South America to a place where people eat their pets. Why? He was a communist. He took power and destroyed everything like communists do. So after that operation in Venezuela, we vaporized his tomb, which is a hilarious, spiteful thing to do. Now, how was that received by American Democrats?
Chavez made sure that millions of kids who never had access to education would. He did so by sometimes using the Venezuelan army to seize the property of U.S. companies. He seized the oil and used that money for the Venezuelan oil, nationalized the oil to pay for social services. The quality of life for the poor in Venezuela skyrocketed. And today, the U.S. Empire bombed his grave. They want to destroy the memory of the hero, Hugo Chavez. Viva Chavez!
Yeah. I'll see you tomorrow.